Okay. Well, thanks very much for the opportunity to speak. The problem I want to address is the problem of where super-Earth atmospheres originated. You know, in one of her earlier papers, Leslie Rogers outlined three possible origin stories for the atmosphere of GJ-1214b. The atmosphere could have been outgassed from rock, could be the sublimated remains of ices brought in from beyond the ice line, from planets that migrated inwards. And finally, the atmospheres could have been directly accreted from the primordial protoplanetary disk. And this last option, this third option, that I'll focus on exclusively, and we will assess quantitatively this proposal. This is work that's done in collaboration with Chris Ormel, Becky Dawson. The principal driver is Eve Lee. She's the one who's done most of the work and from whom I've learned the most about this subject. We didn't start by asking the question how super-Earths acquired their atmospheres. We asked a slightly different question, which was how do they avoid accreting too much? And that's because of this result of the thousands of super-Earths discovered by Kepler. Some lucky 65 of them have had their masses measured by radial velocity observations. So here's their distribution of masses between 5 and 10 Earth masses. And this result did not sit well with us because it didn't connect with our textbook view of our understanding of how gas giants form. Right? This is the story that we tell our children when we, especially when we want them to stop bothering us and go to bed. How did Jupiter form, they ask. So once upon a time, there was a rocky core whose mass was 10 Earth masses. It was so big and whose gravity was so strong that it accreted all the gas surrounding it and inflated to become Jupiter. Well, these critical core masses that are bandied about in literature are exactly the masses that you find among these super-Earths. So how is it that they avoided that fate? How is it that the universe made itself safe for the existence of super-Earths and not all these Jupiters? It's not to say that super-Earths don't have atmospheres. They just have rather modest ones. Modest ones by mass, of course, not modest by volume. They dominate the volume. But by mass, the gas to core ratios, GCRs, mass of gas divided by the mass of the core. These are results inferred from the interior models of Eric Lopez and Jonathan Fortney. And they tell us, right, based on radius mass measurements, that the GCRs are on the order of a percent, give or take, in order of magnitude. So our job is to try to reproduce this result. I'm focusing the discussion for the moment on objects that are less than 4 Earth radii. These are the objects that comprise the lion's share of extrasolar planets discovered inside periods of 100 days. We could talk about the super puffies as well, but for now I'm going to focus on the majority of the population. These atmospheres that Lopez and Fortney run, they're hydrogen-helium atmospheres. It took me a few months to read the fine print. Fine print says that typically, not always, but typically, when people say hydrogen helium atmospheres, they really mean metal-enriched atmospheres. Zs, up to 0.5, many times solar. There are many motivations for this. One of the original ones, I think, is that one was working by analogy with Neptune, whose envelope is known to be highly metal-enriched. Okay, but there are observations as well, which will discuss arguing in favor of these metal-enriched atmospheres. So I hesitate to call them hydrogen helium, but that's what people call them, so that's what we'll call them. They say that life is all about timing, and with regards to the question of whether a super-Earth becomes a Jupiter, to be or not to be a Jupiter, that is a question that is decided about time scales. T runaway versus T disk. So the question is, whether you can form a 10 Earth mass core and accrete enough gas for you to undergo runaway before the gas disk goes away. All right, so this is a literally a textbook plot. Now it's a textbook plot from Pollock et al., showing the mass of the core versus time. If you achieve something like 10 Earth masses, you're accreting this atmosphere, nice and steady, over several million years. But at some point, you notice that the pace of accretion really accelerates. Right? It runs away. And the moment at which it accelerates, you can see it, the atmospheric mass crosses the core mass. That's when the self-gravity of the envelope becomes significant. So now the atmosphere gravitationally collapses, and nebular gas rushes in to refill the Hill sphere, and in this way you explode to become Jupiter. Annoyingly enough, the time scale for this particular model is measured in millions of years. We'll see if there's a very good physical reason why it's always going to be measured in millions of years. I'll show you that in a second. But annoyingly enough, it's comparable, right, to disk lifetimes, which are also measured in millions of years. So whether or not you form a Jupiter, maybe all this happened in a disk whose lifetime was 10 million years, in which case conditions are ripe for forming a gas giant. But maybe you have a disk which doesn't stick around for very long, maybe 5 million years, and in that case, conditions are safe for preserving the super-Earth. I can say a little bit more about this disk lifetime. You know, when everyone says, I hear this so often over the last many, many meetings, people say, oh, well, when the disk gas goes away, whenever I hear that, I think, wow, it's the disk gas is like this really genteel dinner guest that knows exactly when to go away. They never overstay their welcome, okay? And it hides, whenever we say this, it hides our ignorance for how disk dispersal, the physics of disk dispersal. How is it that this disk gas actually viscously accretes onto the central star? This is a long-standing problem. So disk dispersal were largely, I would say almost exclusively, informed by observations and not by theory. So what are these observations? Well, the observations tell us that, you know, if you have a star which is 1 million years old, they all have disks. This is gauged by their infrared excesses. But by the time the star is some 10 million years, almost none of them have disks. So the disk lifetime is measured in millions of years. There's a little bit more information than this. And that's shown in this plot, which I decided, after trying really hard to explain, it has just too much chauvinistic astronomical language. So I'm not going to try. But I'll leave it for the diehard astronomers to make sense of this plot. I'm sure you can do it. But I'll tell you what the punchline is, okay? Quantitatively, what's the punchline? The punchline is that people observe a special class of disk, so-called transitional disks, which are on their way to dispersing. They're clearing out. What are these transitional disks? They have giant holes where inside of something like 10 AU, it looks empty. Okay, it's optically thin. So they're in the middle of clearing out. From the inside out, it looks like. These transitional disks comprise 10% of the disk population, and that 10% is interpreted as a time spent, right? So the disks stick around for something like 5 to 10 million years, but when they decide to go, they go in 10% of that time. So a fraction, a tenth, 5 to 10 mega years gives you a fast dispersal time scale of a half to 1 mega year. Okay, so there are actually two time scales to disk dispersal. And it's just like the dinner guest phenomenon, right? When one person decides to go very quickly, everyone else wants to go as well. So they file out the door in a tenth of the time. So we'll be referring to these two timescales for disk dispersal later on in the talk. And there is some theory. There's promising work. This was done, people like Kathy Clark, James Owen, trying to reproduce this two timescale behavior for disk dispersal. I think it's promising. It combines viscous accretion with photoevaporation. I would say, you know, just for the aficionados, that this is interesting work, although it's subject to large uncertainties about non-ideal MHD effects related to the MRI, okay? We're just gonna use these numbers, which are informed exclusively by the observations.
Your diagnostics are dust, and your annotation is gas. Do you want to say a quick word about how you associate gas with
Well, I kind of can keep a whole lecture about this. So this is infrared dust. So it's the inner, it's a tracer of the inner disk, hot dust, infrared emission. And this is a trace of millimeter wave emission, which is the outer disk. Now, your question was more about, you know, how do we know that there's gas there? Okay, two lines of evidence. One is that to produce this infrared radiation, the dust has to be lofted up a few scale heights above, and that's provided by the gas, which keeps the dust in the photosphere so that you can reprocess it to produce the 3.6 and 8 micron emission. Second, for the millimeter wave continuum emission, wherever you see the millimeter wave continuum emission from dust, you also see CO. So it's the CO gas, which is tracing to H2. So how does this, you know, you throw a rock into one of these disks, and how is it that they're supposed to accrete an atmosphere? Well, to cool is to accrete. To accrete is to cool. This is what I've learned about this subject. So you throw a rock into the nebula. It binds the gas within its Hill sphere or Roche lobe, whatever you prefer, and you just wait. You wait for that gas to radiate away its energy, cool off, lose pressure support, and gravitationally contract onto the core. In this way, you contract, and the Hill sphere has to refill from all the gas from the nebula above. So the accretion time step, right, delta m over m dot, it's really a cooling time step. To cool is to accrete. To accrete is to cool. So it's a cooling time scale. In other words, it's the Kelvin-Helmholtz time scale. It's just the change in energy when you accrete more mass from the nebula divided by the cooling luminosity. That's a Kelvin-Helmholtz time scale. And the reason why it's mega years is because you can work this out, you can estimate it. The cooling time scale, the Kelvin-Helmholtz time scale for atmospheres that weigh a few percent of the mass of the core, you can work it out. It's millions of years. So this is a robust estimate. It doesn't really matter where you are in the disk. It's always measured in millions of years, which is really annoying because it's comparable to the disk lifetime. What's not so annoying is that it's much larger than the sound crossing time scale across the atmosphere. So these atmospheres maintain very, very closely a hydrostatic equilibrium. And this inequality of time scales suggests a very nice method for computing this accretion history. This is a method that was outlined in a really nice paper. I really like it. Anna Maria Pizzo and Andrew Uden, who used this inequality to construct the following method, which we applied to compute the accretion histories of these atmospheres. They were interested in the outer parts of the solar system, you know, 100 AU or so, in anticipation of GPI results. We applied their method to the inner solar system to try to understand these Kepler atmospheres. And the method is as follows. It's really simple. You construct these hydrostatic snapshots, right? So in a given snapshot, I take a core, I specify a certain mass atmosphere, whatever you want, and then I just solve the equations of stellar structure. I solve in particular for the luminosity required to keep the atmosphere in a hydrostatic equilibrium. And then I repeat for another snapshot, this time with a different atmospheric gas fraction. Right? I can keep increasing the amount of mass in the atmosphere, and the rate at which I play the movie forward depends upon the cooling time, which I can compute because it's just the change in energy between still frames divided by the luminosity, which I had to solve for to maintain the thing in static equilibrium. There are many details, technical details that we had to sort out. I will mention this qualitative point, which I think is significant, and which I'll discuss later on. One of the assumptions of this method, all right, is that there's no extra sources of power in the atmosphere. It's just passively cooling. Now, you can ask, well, maybe there are planetesimals raining down upon the atmosphere and providing an extra source of power. And this is typically done for calculations of Jupiter out at a few AU. All these planetesimals raining down, and it's an extra source of power. I will argue that this source of power, this extra source of accretional luminosity from planetesimals raining down is negligible. And I argue that because the timescale for sweeping up all the small bodies at distances of 0.1 to 0.5 AU, where time scales are really short, okay, that accretional timescale, the timescale to vacuum up all those small bodies, as we've heard from the talks earlier this morning, is incredibly short. So I'm not going to worry about those planetesimals as a first approximation. The second thing I'm not going to worry about, but we will worry about two slides from now, is the core luminosity. So there's this binding energy, right? You form the core, and you need to radiate that out. I've asked some geophysicists at this conference who very helpfully informed me that this is an unsolved problem, that the answer could range by orders of magnitude. Having thought about it a little bit more, I think it doesn't really matter so much, and I'll explain quantitatively why I say that a couple slides from now. But just keep in mind, there is this core luminosity that for our fiducial models, I'm going to neglect. All right, this is the last setup before I present the results. You know, what sets the outer boundary condition? You know, how much gas is there left around? This is uncertain. Here's a little timeline for how these solid cores form. You know, at the very beginning, it's just completely shrouded in mystery how it is that pebbles grow to become kilometer-sized objects. I don't know. I don't know how long this takes. But eventually, the bodies become large enough that the bodies sweep up all the material within their local feeding zones, so-called era of oligarchy. Now it's a question, if you want to keep building, it's a question of waiting for these oligarchs to perturb one another gravitationally so that their orbits cross and merge so that you can undergo successive doublings, okay, in mass. And the time scale over which this occurs in the presence of a gas disk can vary by orders of magnitude. It all depends upon the surface density of the disk, what the oligarch spacings are, how much gas there's around. From the simulations that Becky had shown yesterday, coagulation timescales can range anywhere from 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 7 years. Even down at 0.1 AU, finding that the timescale could be as long as 10 to the 7 years was a real surprise for me. But it's borne out in coagulation simulations. It really depends upon the details of oligarchy. So, faced with this uncertainty, we have two scenarios, two N-member cases. Scenario A, maybe all this happens really quick. Maybe it happens so quick that there's a full gas disk around. I call this scenario A. There's 200 times more mass in gas. Gas disk is still fully present versus the solid cores. 200 is just the inverse of the dust to gas ratio down there at 0.2 AU. Scenario B, all of this happens late, so late that the gas disk is largely depleted. How depleted? I'm really not sure. There's a good physical reason to believe that you do have to wait to form cores. You have to wait for the gas disk to go away because gas exerts dynamical friction on cores, which circularizes their orbits and prevents them from merging. Because you need for the gas surface density to go down sufficiently. How sufficiently? I couldn't tell you with great confidence. Maybe you just need as much mass and gas as there is in the cores. Maybe you need a tenth of that. Maybe you need a hundredth of that. It depends, as far as I can tell, on oligarch spacings, masses, and eccentricities. Okay, so we have these two cases. And you can guess, right? You can guess that scenario B, by construction, is going to automatically solve the problem of runaway, because there just isn't enough gas around. It remains to ask the question, is there enough gas to actually give you the 1% or even 10% atmospheres for the majority of super-Earths? So here are the results. How much time do I have? Okay. Results for scenario A. Can we avoid runaway? This is the hardest possible problem, right? Can we avoid runaway in a full gas disk? And the answer is yes, barely. And only if the dust-to-gas ratio is really orders of magnitude above solar. So 20 times solar. You need for these atmospheres in a full gas disk to be really dusty. Right? Z of like 0.4. And why is that? You need that because you need to increase the opacities in these atmospheres to the point where their cooling luminosities are much lower. And in this way, you can prolong cooling and prolong the accretion and thereby avoid runaway. So this is a plot of GCR, the atmospheric gas fraction versus time. Just focus on the solid curves for now, right? So these two solid curves bracket, we hope, the answer somewhere in between. It depends on what these two solid curves are varying the outer boundary condition. Maybe it's at the Hill sphere, maybe it's half of the Hill sphere, we're not really not quite sure. Hopefully the answer is somewhere in between. And by the time T disk slow has elapsed, right, because of the full gas disk, because that's the time scale that's relevant, you're getting a GCR between what, 20% and 50%. So you've just sort of staved off that fate. You've avoided becoming promoted, but just barely. Our department right now is actually looking for a chair. So several of us, not all of us, but several of us are scrambling to avoid being promoted. And in this particular case, the super Earth has just barely done it. Now this actually overshoots, right? The GCRs that I quoted earlier, which range 1% typically, plus or minus an order of magnitude. But there are ways of knocking down that GCR. There's photoevaporation. There's the core luminosity, which I promised I would get to, which I will get to now. This is uncertain. We know that it'll lower the GCR. By how much? Well, at most, it'll lower it by, I think, a factor of order unity. And how did I achieve that result? I achieved that result by taking the binding energy of the core, 10 Earth mass core, gm squared over r, 10 to the 41 ergs. What is the time scale over which that binding energy is released? I don't know. But the most it could possibly matter for this problem is if it's released over T disk slow. Because if it's released over a time scale much shorter than that, well, then the battery runs out and it's over, and I don't need to worry about it. If it's released over a time scale much longer than that, then I also don't care, because the luminosity is very low. The most it could possibly matter is if this binding energy happens to be released over T disk slow. And in that case, I get 3 times 10 to the 26 ergs per second. 3 times 10 to the 26 ergs per second is 1, 2, 3, which I read off this curve here, L, which I then read off this GCR curve, which means that I have succeeded in knocking down the GCR from a fat 50% to a somewhat slimmer 10%. Which I regard as still acceptable. There are other reasons for favoring scenario A. I mean, for many years, people have talked about aerodynamic drift. I love aerodynamic drift. Solids, they accrete inwards. This is undeniable. Great. This is exactly what we need to produce the large dust-to-gas ratios that are present in inner disks. How could anyone deny aerodynamic drift? I do not. super Earth atmospheres, super solar, 20 times solar, is this crazy? I don't think so. Flat spectra, transmission spectra for many of these super Earths, they seem to require metal rich atmospheres. Z of 0.4, plausible. Even in the interpretation where it's filled with clouds, the only way to form those clouds is in the metal-rich atmosphere. Now, despite these, what I would say, pros of a full nebula, there are several cons that make me increasingly uncomfortable with putting all this activity in a full nebula. The solution is precarious. Z of 0.4 is okay, barely. Too small and it doesn't work, you go run away. Too large and you also go to run away. You've increased the opacity, but in making Z too large, you've also increased the molecular weight, which contracts the scale height, which and you gravitationally collapse the atmosphere, and you go run away. Okay, so this is dangerous. There's another danger. These opacities that we're all using include dust, but the dust can actually gravitationally sediment out of the radiative layers of these atmospheres. It's actually uncertain whether it does or not. We estimated the time scale for this drift, which is on the order of a million years. Just the sedimentation within the envelope itself, the radiative envelopes of these atmospheres. Well, if that happens, and it could happen, then there's a Kappa catastrophe, because you suddenly lose all that opacity which you needed to stave off runaway. And finally, as we've heard this morning, and which I fully agree with, a full gas disk is really a terrible place to raise your children, because you just lose them to orbital migration of one form or another. All of these cons with a full gas disk are alleviated, if not solved, in our scenario B, which again, by construction, almost trivially, avoids the problem of runaway, because there just isn't enough gas disk around. Orbital migration is lessened, the disk doesn't have enough angular momentum. How much disk gas is left depends, I'll say again, on the details, on what these spacings are between the bodies. That degree of stirring, viscous stirring between the bodies, is very sensitive to how far the spacings are, what the masses are, what the eccentricities are. So I don't know how much gas, how much you need to deplete. I'll show you now in the next slide a solution where I depleted it just by assumption to the point where there was as much mass in gas as there was in the solids. And in this case, this is what you get. GCR versus time, okay, again, we hope the answer is somewhere in between here. Now we're measuring against T-disk fast, right, because it's a depleted scenario now. And you're getting between 10 and 20%. Again, a little bit on the fat side compared to the GCRs, which I quoted earlier. But not crazy, in the ballpark. You can lower it by all these you can make appeals, right, to these things which I've already appealed to lower it if you're not comfortable with something as large as 20%. I'll note that this answer, this GCR versus time curve, for scenario B actually looks really similar to scenario A. Right? It's because the cooling history is independent, it's insensitive, I should say, to the nebular environment. Because the cooling history is all set by the radiative convective boundary deep in the interior of the atmosphere. And there's a radiative layer which connects the two. And so by the time, you know, in the radiative layer, there's a strong density gradient. So by the time you've reached the RCB, the radiative convective boundary, you've largely forgotten what the nebula was like. So the rate at which you cool is largely insensitive to how much disk gas there was around. This was recognized really early on in paper by Dave Stevenson, who pointed out that the atmosphere decouples from the external environment when you have a radiative zone. It's my second to last slide, I think. Nebular accretion predicts at a fixed time that more massive cores should have more massive envelopes, of course. So we can quantify this statement, right? We can plot atmospheric gas fractions versus core mass. There's two regimes here. It's of some interest. At low core masses, there's so little atmosphere that the cooling times of these little atmospheres, they've maximally cooled. You go isothermal. It's isothermal now between the external environment and the base of the atmosphere. You've accreted as much as you possibly can. And as much as you possibly can is between 10 to the minus 6 and 10 to the minus 3 for basically sub-Earth objects. For larger cores, you create so much atmosphere that you're still busily cooling. Okay, there's a lot of thermal inertia there. So you're still cooling, and you're still growing, and at a fixed time, you find that the atmospheric gas fraction scales as a power law, which we're working right now to try to explain, and we're reasonably confident that we can reproduce this slope eventually, just by using the statement that the cooling time, it's all controlled by cooling, so whatever the cooling time is of the atmosphere is however much time has elapsed. So from this statement, one can recover, I believe, this power law slope. Second to last slide. Nebular accretion at fixed time predicts that more massive cores should have more massive envelopes. Is this borne out by the data? When I looked at this plot, when we looked at this plot, it was really pretty depressing. We thought, well, you know, not a whole lot to say about this. In particular, there's this 8 Earth mass string of points, you know, pretty much the same, thank you, mass. And wouldn't it be wonderful, Eve and I said to ourselves, wouldn't it be just like the greatest miracle if, in fact, this string of points somehow traced photoevaporation? Wouldn't it be awesome if these low guys were the most strongly irradiated and these high guys were the least strongly irradiated? Well, she went off and made the plot. And a miracle occurred. There it is. This is more than I deserve. But look, it's, you know, the log incident flux. I know this is bolometric flux, but it's really tracing 1 over distance squared, okay, which is the same as XUV flux, because these are all stars of the same spectral type, so it doesn't really matter. But yeah, the most strongly irradiated ones are the ones with the least UCR, and it's good. You can tell a story about this string of points. What about these guys over here? Well, this is, you know, there aren't a whole lot of points. But I think there's a hidden variable in the problem, right? We think there's a hidden variable in the problem, and the hidden variable problem is time, because I think high mass cores, it's plausible. We find this. Everyone finds this from the coagulation simulations. Take longer to grow. So if they take longer to grow, then there's less gas disk around, and so you can that tends to randomize the points and lower the GCRs. This is my last slide. Do I think super Earth cores, do I think super Earth atmospheres, accreted atmospheres from accretion from the nebula? Yes, I do. Do I think they did it in a full gas nebula? No, I don't. I think accreted it all in a depleted gas disk. How much depleted? I've told you I don't know, but I can make some order of magnitude estimates. Did all this happen in situ, or did the planets migrate? Just from an angular momentum consideration, the amount by which the planets migrate, delta A over A, has to scale with how much gas disk is around compared to the things that you're trying to move around. If there was migration, that degree of migration, I think, was order unity at most. But there are certainly cases where that is not the case. So I'll stop there.
I'll kick it off. Did the super puffies stay bathed in their nebula for a long time to get such a big atmosphere?
That's one story one can tell. But maybe I was thinking the super puffies might be sort of a tail end of a gas giant population. People talk about migration for gas giants, and there I think that's sensible, based on the Rossiter-McLaughlin measurements and of all these crazy angles. I think bringing in hot Jupiters from planet-planet scattering is a good idea, and I've worked on this. Could it be that the super puffies are the tail end, or are part of, one should think of them more as a migrated giant planet population? Yeah. Super puffies, I'll also point out, right, you told us not to ignore them, and I'm trying really hard not to.
Thank you.
But they are they're rare, right?
Fair enough.
They're very rare. Just like Jupiters are.
Thank you for this nice talk, Eugene. So I was curious of what you have in mind for the. So I of course agree with you that there's very little migration in the already depleted gas disk of the cores. But what do you envision happens when the full gas disk around, and what do you imagine happens to the cores? I mean, where do they come from? Once the gas disk is already depleted by a factor of 100, and you have cores, I think it's no problem. But it's not clear to me how you would get to that state. What do you have in mind?
It's not completely clear to me either. I mean, solids and gas can evolve their separate ways. So if the bodies are large enough, they can stick around at 0.1, 0.2, 0.3 AU. As the gas disk photoevaporates and viscously accretes onto the central star, that can leave a lot of solids around. And from those solids, one can form these isolation masses and these protocores and eventually cores. So I think that can happen in place. Now, whether that material originally came from much further out, I think it almost certainly did, right? The raw material almost certainly had to have originated from further away, because it's an accretion disk, for crying out loud. And all the material here eventually came from the molecular cloud. So did we come from a migrated population? Yes, in that trivial sense.
Eugene, over here. I had one question. In scenario A, you basically said, you can only go avoid runaway growth if you basically have low enough opacities. Sorry, high enough
opacities.
And so basically you would need to have a dusty or and or list the atmosphere. I was wondering, because you're so sensitive to the time scale, how do you model the radiative layer? Do you assume a gray atmosphere in a way, or do you
Oh no. So we take, it's not gray at all.
Right.
We asked Jason Ferguson for his opacities. So we're using Ferguson opacities.
Okay.
And we put dust in it for a fiducial model, which avoids the runaway. But we can also run the simulation, we can also run the model without without dust. But yes, our opacities are certainly not gray.
Yeah.
They're crazy. They're absolutely, yeah. It's a function of only of temperature.
And basically, do you model the chemistry?
They do that. Very good question. So they do that for us.
Okay.
Ferguson does that for us.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, in thermodynamic equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
You started with the interpretation of disk observations as saying that disk dispersal happens on 10 to the 5-year time scales. But then you went ahead.
T-disk fast can be between half to 1 megayears. It's not quite 10 to the 5.
But do you actually believe that interpretation of the observations? In fact, you don't want to, right? Because you want your disk to disperse slowly, so it sticks around for your million years that you have to accrete. Why isn't that observation just indicating that 10% of stars have gas giants that clear a gap in the disk?
I suppose that's an alternative interpretation, sure. Is that the gas goes into systems with lots of gas giants. Now, do we actually have a 10%? Do we know that the occurrence rate of Jupiters out at, 5 to 10 AU is 10%? Well, actually, I was going to say yes. Cummings' work. These are the sorts of orders of magnitude that are involved. But it's a lot. I mean, Jupiter only has, 10 to the minus 3, right, of a solar mass. And these disks typically have more than that. So, okay, well, you have to put it in something like 10 Jupiters, right? You have to put 0.01 solar masses worth of disk into 10 Jupiters. So sure, that's an alternative interpretation, which at the moment I cannot rule out.
Was there a follow-up? No? Okay, Eric.
No, but David has a hand up too.
Show me your hands if you want the next question.
More about dissipation timescales. So I think you appreciate this, but just to be clear for people who don't look at these plots, that decay curve over 10 million years does not say that it takes 10 million years for a disk to dissipate. That's a statistical observation. So it means that some disks disappear very quickly, and some disks appear to hang around a long time.
Good.
So what
good.
You have is a diversity of outcomes.
Good, good, good.
And so
good.
You can, depending good. On the statistics of how many systems you have to explain, you can appeal to very short time scales or very long time scales. And you have an extra degree of freedom in the system. Of course, you have to come back and do the statistics right.
That's a good point.
There's,
agreed.
This is,
yeah, that's right. No, this is ensemble.
This is an ensemble plot.
So that's a good point.
Yeah.
Let me just express right now, it's just incredibly annoying to me how all the timescales related to this problem are all comparable to one another. Okay. It's just incredibly frustrating.
May you live in an
universal. Okay. Jack?
What factor of mass growth do you need from the embedded in a gas-rich disk to embedded to the ultimate mass of the planet in order for the post-mergers in the chaotic regime, ultimate size of the solid, to dominate the gas content of the planet over what you get with the smaller cores in the gas-rich nebula?
I followed you at the second comma. Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry.
You have the planets in your model. You're saying the planets grow to their ultimate sizes in a gas-poor disk.
Yes.
What is the ratio of the ultimate sizes to the sizes they were when the gas was holding them back from growth. Because let's say you have two Earth mass cores, you get rid of the gas and a pair merges and then they're still stable and they're four Earth mass. You've had those two Earth mass cores around for a few million years in a gas-rich disk, and you have to compare that with the four.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, it's really steep. I mean, I suppose if I understand the question correctly, which I'm not sure I do, but I mean, two Earth masses, what I suppose you can read it off this plot, I suppose, you know, puts you at a percent atmosphere. This is at a mega year, sitting there, yeah. So you've already accreted something like a percent. Now, you know, you still have to get your way up to 5 to 10 Earth masses to get true super Earth. And impacts, as Hilke has shown very nicely, can reduce those atmospheres. Although major mergers, she finds, aren't so efficient. Maybe a factor of two, if I understood your results correctly.
Hi, Eugene. So unless I missed something, so you're using the opacity of the accreted gas to limit cooling, which allows the planet radius to stay small.
In scenario A, which I don't favor, but yes.
Ah, okay. Because I was gonna ask about, so this makes the prediction that so higher opacity envelopes create smaller planets. So if the opacity of the envelope correlates with the metallicity of the star, then you predict an inverse correlation between the metallicity of the star and the size of the planets. But we don't see any kind of correlation. So I was going to ask you how you reconcile the prediction there with the lack of the correlation that we observe.
I think that's just one more reason not to believe in scenario A.
Okay.
Okay, more questions? Jumping back to, well, you have the slide here. Leveraging off Jack's question, do you expect that multiple planets in the same system will have the same time in which to capture disks, such that if there's a diversity of core masses, we should see a trend in atmosphere?
Diversity?
Yeah, should there be a larger atmospheric fraction for a larger core mass within a single system?
Oh, within a single system. Oh, I didn't think about that. Right. I would say not necessarily, even within a single system, because the time it takes to form, you know, a 10 Earth mass core at, I don't know, half an AU versus 0.3 AU, those times could be very different. And so they generally are very different. And so because those times are very different, the amount of gas that's still around for those two equal mass objects will be very different.
What if
so
they
it's two
lie
different
within
times, two different time slices?
What if they lie within a factor of two in orbital radius from each other, like the TTV system?
You know, I think even a factor of two could generate enough variance in the formation times.
I can't pin you down. All right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would love to. Well, yeah. I think there's enough variance. Yeah.
Any final questions? All right, let's thank our speakers. I think you have growling stomachs. Enjoy lunch.